Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Axis Bank PLC 2019 full year results presentation. All participants are currently in listen-only mode. There will be an opportunity to ask questions later during this conference. If you should need assistance during this call, please signal an operator by pressing star then zero. Please note that this call is being recorded. I would now like to turn the conference over to Herbert Wigwe. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you very much, Chris, and a very good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. You are all welcome to Access Bank's full year 2019 earnings call. We prepared a very detailed presentation highlighting all aspects of our business, which we're going to be sharing with you right now. On the call with me today are Mr. Roosevelt Ogbonna, who is our Group Deputy Managing Director, Greg Jogome, who is our Executive Director in charge of Risk Management, Ade Bajomo, in charge of IT and Operations, Mr. Victor Etuoku, who is our Executive Director of Personal Banking, Chizoma Okoli, our Executive Director of Business Banking, Adiza Ambrosa, Executive Director of Commercial Banking, and Mr. Shea Kumakwai, who is our Chief Financial Officer. As you are aware, we've completed our merger with Diamond Bank in 2019, and therefore most of the numbers I will share with you will reflect the impact of the merger. I will briefly go over some of the key performance highlights, after which we will allow more than enough time for questions and answers session with you. Let's first stick to delivering on our strategy and merger synergies. As earlier said, we've now completed the merger and operate as one organization, one culture, one system, one set of processes, achieving the target value creation set for ourselves. We've realized merger synergies of about 59.9 billion naira, comprising largely of recoveries, lower cost of funds, and contract renegotiations. And this puts us far ahead of our run rate because at the time we're sharing with you, the merger synergies we saw coming from this combination were expected about 155 billion over a 3-year period. And in the first year, we've made about 59.9, which is about 60 billion in the first year. The merger has started to create value as post-merger metrics have far exceeded those of the individual banks on a stand-alone basis. Some of the metrics are as follows. When we look at the customer deposits, Access Bank, as at the end of the first quarter 2019, was 2.8 trillion in terms of deposits. Diamond Bank was 1 trillion naira, and so the combined was about 3.9 trillion. We closed the year 2019 with 4.2 trillion naira of customer deposits. More interesting are the retail metrics. If you look at the retail transaction income for Diamond Bank for the first quarter of 2019, it was 6.7 billion. Access Bank, it was 4.3 billion. And so if you combine it, it was 11 billion. And on an annualized basis, about 44 billion was expected in 2019. However, at the end of the year, we did about 52 billion naira, which is 17% above the combined entities when you annualize the income. Same thing with respect to point of sales collection. On a combined basis, at 34 billion at the end of the first quarter, which meant annualized, it would have been about 414 billion naira. We ended up at about 518 billion. Our monthly cards volumes on a combined basis was about 243,000 cards, which meant that in the full year, we would have done about 2.9 million cards in issuance. But what we did was 4 million cards, which is about 39% growth. With respect to USSD, same thing, combined would have been 58 billion naira on a quarterly basis in terms of transactions, meaning that we would have run about 697 billion for the full year on a combined basis, but we did about a trillion naira. Mobile and internet banking, basically on a combined basis, would have been about a trillion naira in the first quarter, meaning 12 billion naira, at the end of the first at the end of 2019, but what we did was 17 trillion naira, these are trillion naira terms. Basically, it just shows that in terms of the combined entity, with respect to the retail metrics, we are beginning to see value coming out of it. Let's go into the group performance highlights. Our gross earnings grew by 26%, closing at about 666 billion in the period, compared to 528.7 billion in 2018, comprising of 81% interest income, and 19% non-interest income. Interest income, of course, was up by about 41%, to about 536 billion. And of course, the key contributors to this growth include 86% coming from investment securities, which rose to about 193 billion in the period, compared to 103 billion in the corresponding period of last year. We saw a 28% rise in interest in loans to about 334 billion compared to 262 billion in the previous year, of course, resulting from the combined and growing loan book. As a result, our net interest income from the overall balance sheet improved by 60% to 277 billion in the financial year ended 2019 compared to 173 billion for 2018. Our operating income increased by 25% to 389 billion from 311 billion in the corresponding period of 2018, owing largely to the significant growth in net interest income and other operating income. The key drivers of our operating income were as follows: a 48% increase in our commission on fees to 91.8 billion in 2019, compared to 62.1 billion in 2018. This was, of course, attributable to the increased retail transaction charges, commissions on channels and electronic business income, as well as account maintenance charge. We will continue to gain traction on these income lines as we continue to extend our retail offerings and as we basically grow as one combined institution, basically stabilizing for growth. Also, we saw increased contribution from our other operating income, which basically came from gains from other financial services, disposal of property and equipment, and about 38.4 billion coming from the recoveries of fully written off bad loans, which was one of the things we said we were basically going to pursue aggressively as soon as the combination was done. On the other hand, we saw a decrease in our net trading income to a loss of 17.7 billion naira from a gain of 72.6 billion in 2018. Of course, this was accounted for by our foreign exchange losses and, of course, the revaluation and reduction on the gain in derivatives and equity investments. When you analyze this properly, you will see that there was significant unwinding of most of the underlying derivative contracts which were maturing as we move closer to maturity of the instruments. However, as you will see in 2020, these have been very carefully modeled into our financial plans to minimize and ensure that there's minimal impact on volatility as far as profitability is concerned. Our interest expense increased by 25% to 259.6 billion in 2019, coming from 207.3 billion in 2018. This was largely driven by the size of the enlarged deposit base resulting from the merger and interest expense on our structured funding. We have largely wound down and repriced this book, and this is beginning to reflect in our cost of funding, which has continued its descent by 50 basis points in the last quarter of last financial year. And today, that figure is around about 3.5% in terms of our composite interest cost when you compare it to 5.5% as at December 2018. The full impact of that figure, obviously, will be felt in 2020 as we begin to enjoy the benefits of low interest rates and the fact that we've been able to migrate our cost of funds downwards significantly and increase our savings accounts, current accounts mix in terms of the overall composition in 2020. As regards to costs, operating expenses were up by 31% year on year to 253.8 billion compared to 194 billion in 2018. Now, this was as a result of increasing in personnel expense, depreciation, AMCON, IT, and e-business expenses. The primary reason you would have seen this growth was the fact that we had to create a lot of slack in the course of 2019 to ensure that integration would not affect our overall customer experience and service while we're basically coupling the two institutions. Secondly, we had to ensure that we harmonize our pay structure of the combined entity, and so you've basically seen that increase go up. But as you would see in 2020, when we talk about the outlook, the effects and coming from the natural attrition of staff and all of that, this figure will wind down very, very significantly in 2020 as we move into the year. With respect to customer deposits, this closed at about 4.26 trillion, which basically reflected a 66% year-on-year growth from 2.56 trillion in December 2018 and a 0.4% quarter on quarter from September 2019. The growth was primarily driven by the 93% year-to-date increase in our CASA deposits. So what you begin to see is very significant growth as far as our current and savings account is concerned. You see it more in 2020 from the savings account levels, where we expect that very shortly we shall cross the 1 trillion naira mark. And this has basically come from our enhanced retail presence, leveraging on our innovative digital platform and the synergistic effects of the merger. With respect to loans and advances, this stood at about 3 trillion as of 31st December 2019, again up from 2.14 trillion in December 2018. Again, this has come from the combination and careful risk asset creation to quality corporate names and also supporting the retail segment in line with some of the things which the central bank intends to project. Overall, the group's asset quality remains under check as our non-performing loan ratio stood at 5.8% in the period compared to the nine-month figure, which was 6.3%. And of course, the key sectors that are responsible for this are the oil and gas services at 14.8%, general commerce at 11.1%, real estate activities at about 7.4%. We will continue to drive down the non-performing loan ratio to our traditional levels, which we're used to prior to the merger, through a combination of write-offs, recoveries, declassification, and loan restructuring on a year-to-date basis. On a year-to-date basis, we've written off a total of about 93 billion, having made full provisions on them. With respect to our expected credit loss charge, this went up by 27% to 21.7 billion in 2019 from 14.2 billion in the previous year. Of course, this was to ensure that we have adequate cover for challenged loans in order to drive our non-performing loan ratio down to our traditional levels. Accordingly, our cost of risk as at the end of the year stood at about 1.9%. In 2019 financial year. This wouldn't be unexpected. In any time of a merger, you know, like this, you will find a couple of things which you didn't pick before the merger in terms of loans. Some of it also coming from the changing macro, and therefore we needed to basically increase our provisioning towards the end of the year. We transferred to our capital adequacy ratio, it closed at about 18.2% on a full impact basis. However, if we consider the regulatory transition arrangement, our capital adequacy ratio stood at 20.4%. Liquidity ratio was at 47%, and both of them far in excess of our regulatory minimum requirement. What are the things we need to address? First is cost. Our operating expense was up by 31% year on year, largely by regulatory costs, personnel expense, as I shared before, depreciation, amortization, and outsourcing costs. If you break it down, you will find that personnel recruitment and training expense grew by 33% year-on-year, of course coming from the enlarged staff strength and harmonization, as well as increased salaries. We also saw depreciation and harmonization increase by 57%, reflective of the larger infrastructural base, CAPEX investments to support the larger institution and to create enough room for our strategic drive with respect to more customers and increased activity. You also find about 67% increase in the deposit insurance premium driven by the enlarged deposit base and the inclusion of 9 months NDIC premium amortization for the Defunct Diamond Bank. The 13% increase in AMCON expense also reflects the growth in the asset base of Access Bank between 2017 and 2018. Outsourcing costs went up by about 92%, driven by expanded branch network as well as the harmonized compensation to the increased outsourced staff which we needed to basically use to support our drive, as well as the direct sales agent and some of the initiatives which we are pushing as far as agency banking is concerned. Net trading income decreased by about 124% year-on-year due to a significant drop in the fair value gain on equity investment and, more importantly, derivative instruments coupled with foreign exchange losses and foreign exchange loss on revaluation. So we saw FX trading loss reduced by about 500% year-on-year, and the gain on FX derivative was basically about 60% on a year-on-year basis. And of course, this was completely as a result of the unwinding of derivative contracts as we move closer to maturity of those contracts. Some of those contracts were 2 years old, and what we saw was that the last quarter of the year, a very significant portion of them of it basically matured. Delivering on our retail strategy, we will continue to consolidate the gains of our various strategic decisions targeted at pushing our retail business in line with the next phase of our transformation. We are very heavy on analytics to facilitate understanding of our customers' behavior and preferences. This is done in order to tailor our products, offerings, and marketing efforts, thereby positioning ourselves to capture the huge opportunities in the market. With respect to financial inclusion, we will deploy the necessary resources to reach the unbanked and the underbanked and the unbanked by increasing our agency banking network, strengthening our partnerships with the telcos, and leveraging digital technology. Today, our agency banking network has continued to increase with total agents of about 18,607 across all 36 states. During the year, we were able to reach customers in places where there were no or low presence of banks, or within demographic and economic requirements. Altogether, this has helped us to deliver value propositions such as Access Closer, which essentially refers to our endeavor to basically take moderately priced branches, all right, to the hinterland, all right, where we can get closer and closer to the customer. And of course, better products to millions of customers and facilitated transactions worth about $378 billion as at year end from $29 billion in the first quarter, which shows very significant growth as far as our financial inclusion business is concerned. The Closer initiative was launched in August, later introducing digital transactions such as fast transfer, bill payments, and airtime vending. Our Closer endeavor accounted for about $140 billion worth of transactions carried out by insured customers. On retail digital lending, our digital lending strategy continues to gain momentum as we make available channels of opportunities to eligible customers to finance their dreams and lifestyle fulfillment of our promise to deliver more and more to our customers. In the period, we recorded 107% and 129% year-on-year growth with respect to transaction count and volume respectively through this flagship product. So basically, it was our payday loans, our salary loans, our small ticket loans, as well as device financing. I think we're able to grant about 3.1 million unique loans, all right, to different customers throughout the year. With respect to our outlook for 2020, and we'll speak to the numbers for guidance a bit later, we are committed to driving an effective and sustainable business growth by intensifying our efforts to extract value from new and existing accounts and migrate customers to alternative channels to enhance transaction banking income, which is getting stronger and stronger by the day. We will reduce our operating costs by aggressively executing strategic cost-saving initiatives. Our culture will create a culture around aggressive recovery, which we've already done, and decisively deal with challenge facilities. We will significantly increase the productivity of our people and resources to enable us enhance our operational efficiency. We will intensify our low-cost drive to reducing our cost of funds, thereby enhancing liquidity and margins. And this is particularly important because one of the greatest criticisms we had from analysts was our cost of funds. But I think where we are today, we've basically closed the gap at least by about 85%, you know, when you look at us against our comparator banks. And we believe that by the end of the second quarter, we should be at about very close to the same cost of funds structure as, you know, our comparator banks in the industry. We'll advance our core loan growth with increased focus and asset quality, which is one that we are known for. Let me try and give you guidance for 2020. With respect to profitability, we expect that we are basically looking at getting, you know, our ROE anywhere between 22.5% and 25%. Asset quality ratios, our cost of risk, we see anywhere between 1.2% and 1.5%. Our non-performing loan ratio will definitely be below 5%. With respect to our efficiency ratios, we think our cost to income ratio will be anywhere between 55% and 60%. Our net interest margin will be about 8%, while our cost of funds is expected to be less than 3.5% composite as we run average through the year. With respect to our prudential ratios, capital adequacy will certainly be north of 20%. Our loan-to-deposit ratio will be about 65%, and we expect to continue to maintain liquidity ratios north of 50%. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. We will now take questions from all of you. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question, please put star and then one on your touchtone phone or the keypad on your screen. If you decide to withdraw the question, please press star and then two. Again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star and then one. The first question we have is from Tolo Alamuta from Telemia. Please go ahead.
Okay. Good afternoon. Thank you for hosting the call today. I have a few questions, please. The first is on your foreign currency position. Can you maybe tell us whether you're short or long dollars at the moment, and give us some idea of how short or long you might be? The second is on foreign currency liquidity. Can you tell us how much you estimate that you have available to meet near-term maturities, and do you have any plans to return to the Eurobond market? Then can you also give us some more information on your exposure to SLOC Nigeria? How large is that exposure? How much of it has been provisioned? Any information that you can give would be greatly appreciated. And then also related to asset quality, when oil and gas contracts were restructured in the past, what oil price was assumed in those contracts, please? And how have you stress tested those exposures? And can you also give us some idea of what the impact of a much weaker Naira would be on capital and other metrics? I remember in the past you had said that you had stressed your capital up to, I think, 450 Naira to the dollar or 500, but any detail that you can give on stress testing that you've done now would be appreciated. And finally, just going on the CEO's recent comments regarding your strategy and expanding into more African countries and so on, can you maybe give us some idea of what you would consider an ideal split in terms of revenue or profitability of Nigeria versus the rest of Africa? Thank you.
Okay. With respect to, I'll get Roosevelt to speak to answer questions on foreign currency position, short or long. We are pretty much square now, almost. Foreign currency liquidity, our ability to meet near-term maturity, and whether you will be returning to the Eurobond market. Roosevelt, speak to that.
All right. So on the FCY position and FCY liquidity, on the position, we're about square today. Given some of the actions we've agreed to do within the course of the next 7 days, we will be net long, but it's not a significant position in that sense. For us, it's not to expose ourselves unduly. We're not seeking to make significant gains from it by taking any aggressive position in that sense. From an FCY liquidity perspective, we looked at maturity between 0 and 180-day buckets, which are the more immediate pressure points. We are fine across all the buckets. We are repositioning ourselves to ensure we have liquidity buffers about 10% of our overall portfolio, just to protect ourselves in the event that there are any market shocks that happen that might affect our ability to meet near-term obligations. But 0 to 180 days, we're very comfortable. We have some negative gap between 270 and 360 days, and 2 years over, we're very long on those positions. So we're comfortable, we're monitoring it very closely, and we're with this, we have no plans of returning to the Eurobond market, not at this time at least. Thank you.
Let me just quickly add to Roosevelt's comments. We try to use very sophisticated measures as far as liquidity management is concerned, more specifically around foreign currency liquidity management. And we use measures that are quite close to the ILA, just to make sure that from a contractual standpoint, all right, we don't run into a problem, particularly given what and how we see the market evolving over the next couple of weeks. We think, just as Roosevelt said, over the next 180 days, we are clean, which represents the most significant pressure points, given what the coronavirus is doing to the international market and the repricing and the and the capital outflows which we're seeing. So I think we are doing quite well. I would like Mr. Jogome, our chief risk officer, to basically speak to issues around flock and of course the stress test and the impact on capital adequacy.
Thank you, Herbert. So with respect to SLOC, obviously, whilst trying to skirt the borders of confidentiality, all I can say is that we will do the prudent thing. As you know, Access Bank 4, we have taken significant provision, and as we watch this space, we'll be able to tell you a bit more. But like I said, there's only so much I can say for client confidentiality reasons. But if you can look back at the way we've handled other significant exposures in the past, you know we are very swift and we take decisive action on all of those. Then this is not going to be any different. And with respect to potential devaluation, well, as we have shared in every meeting for the past number of quarters, we have been very, very careful to anticipate the market as it relates to potential for devaluation. Obviously, no one could have predicted coronavirus and this, the immediacy of what has turned out to be the case. So we did anticipate, should there be a devaluation up to 550, we stressed our book up to that level, and at those levels, we were still meeting the regulatory requirements. So that gave us an upper bound. Of course, nobody wants to see those kinds of rates because at that exchange rate, you will find that a good chunk of the market will face a lot of stress. Every sector, whatever sector you are in, whether you're oil and gas, manufacturing or general commerce, you will have a bit of a problem. So our role is to be prudent and prepared should that eventuality happen. Like I've said, at those levels, we will be fine. With the combination with Diamond Bank, of course, that level now comes down. So at about 500, if we maintain the transitional regime that Central Bank has, we'll still be okay. At 550, with the transitional regime, we'll still be okay. Beyond the transitional regime, both our bank and every other bank will, of course, have to think again and probably even the regulator as well. But no one is expected to see exchange rates at that level. So we'll keep our fingers crossed on that.
Let me speak very briefly with respect to our strategy, both African and international, i.e. outside of Africa. I think what we're trying to create is to create an institution that is resilient, will stand the test of time, would have diversified income, not just across the continent, but outside of the continent. You would see us having today one of the strongest African banks in the UK with increased contributions. From a percentage standpoint, and also therefore creating a natural hedge because it operates in a very, very strong currency. And I'm talking about Access Bank UK. It also houses operations in Dubai, which, by the way, is profitable. And our expectation is that over the next couple of years, we will be present in two or three more of the world financial centers. What does that do? It helps to enhance our overall risk rating and to ensure that if you are in soft currency countries, in the main, you'd have hedged yourself, and over time, from a risk rating standpoint, you could see very, very significant upgrades. Now, our ambition as well, of course, in the course of the next 5 years, or going up to 2023 rather, is to be known as Africa's gateway to the world. What that means is that we also need to be present in some of the major trade hubs within the continent. And so, we will be present and we're spreading to a couple of countries outside of Nigeria, as you see, where we can see huge trade volumes benefiting from Africa, trade volumes coming from the contiguous nature and networking around the continent, as well as what we will refer to as one bank names, which are largely big African nationals that have presence across the continent. My expectation is that if we take our overall diversification efforts, Nigeria still represents, within the context of Africa, a very, very significant player. And for Africa, for the rest of Africa to basically contribute up to 25% will take us a bit of time. But our expectation is that perhaps over the next 5 years, the rest of Africa, together with what we have outside of the continent, should start to approach something like 40% contribution. And when that happens in full steam, perhaps it will lead to an upgrade, and where we start to almost look as if we are beginning to pierce the sovereign ceiling. So that is how we intend to see, or that is how we see our internationalization, not just within the continent, but also outside the continent. Thank you. Next question.
Thank you, sir. The next question we have is from Oyekan Ogunbemile from Rand Merchant Bank, Nigeria.
Good afternoon. I just wanted a bit of clarification on the swaps, the unwinding of the swaps that you earlier discussed. If you can please clarify on that, on what happened there.
Okay. All right. If you recall, at the beginning of 2019, we guided that we'll see an unwinding of about 15 billion a quarter on the derivative book. What has happened is not inconsistent with what we expected. What you see is that this comes on the back of the income timing of the income recognition, and therefore you basically tend to see this unwinding, you know, towards the maturity of the instrument. However, what we've done is that we've carefully modeled our financial plan so that you don't see that much volatility anymore. So that's what has happened on the swap book.
We had a very significant proportion with respect to the swaps, a very significant proportion which were a two-year tenor coming at the end of the last quarter of the year. But I think going into 2020, we are beginning to think of how to model it a bit differently so that we're going to basically get out of all of this volatility. And that is what Shei is speaking to. We believe that the swaps also represent a very, very strong and decent source of income for two reasons. One, if there's any institution you can lend to, particularly at a time like this, and this is going to be tested, and you are sure you'll get your money back, I think, you know, the sovereign must represent the best risk. That's the starting point. Now, secondly, with respect to liquidity around it, we've been able to build up our liquidity base to ensure that we can carry this amount of swaps without any liquidity mismatch throughout the period. Thirdly, I think from an earnings standpoint, what you're going to see is that in 2020, it is going to represent a smoother source of income with less volatility on a quarterly basis because of how it is going to be modeled. So we've come up with very stringent measures, all right, with respect to how we model it on a portfolio basis so that we don't see this type of volatility that we saw in the previous year. And finally, and most importantly, we're not taking it long-dated as we did in the past, so you're not likely to see a two-year swap. All swaps are technically within 1 year. And as much as possible, we try to ensure that they will, or if there's any spillover, you will see it in the very early part of the next year. So that is the thing we're doing. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, just a reminder, if you would like to ask a question, please press star and then one. The next question we have is from Rudo Masiri from FMO. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon. I have two questions. The first one, it's possible that I could have missed in your explanation of the stress testing that you've done recently, the effect of the lower oil prices. And the second question is on the LDR, or the loan-to-funding ratio, rather, which is lower than the current CBN expectations, and what your plan is around that.
Okay. Greg will speak to the issue around the lower oil prices and impact on CAR, and as well as the loan to deposit ratio.
Okay. So like I said earlier on, what we do as business as usual is anticipating potential market shocks, and in line with that, we do stress for oil price. Typically, we've done stresses around $30 or $40 per barrel, which is precisely where it is hovering right now. So with hindsight, that was a good, decent benchmark to pick for the stresses. Now, of course, that translates into a certain exchange rate once you mark it historically. And typically, that could take you anything north of 450, 500, 550. So those are the levels that we apply for our stresses. Like I said, we've done this for a good number of years now, so they're not even like new tests that we do. So we're very well familiar with this territory, and we have prepared even down to sectoral level what kind of impact from oil and gas borrowers, what kind of impact from manufacturers, what kind of impact from the whole raft of sectors. But what is common across all is that eventually every sector will be touched, just like I said, if those levels of exchange rate do crystallize. But as we said, those tests help us to anticipate these developments and to prepare for them. So the real benefit for us from those stress tests was that we had taken steps as far back as 2016 and 2017 in anticipation of any such eventuality.
Okay.
With respect to LDR, naturally, the goal is to meet all regulatory requirements and to support our regulator in every way possible. That's precisely what we are doing. To balance that is our challenge. We do still have to be careful so that we don't end up creating an asset quality issue in 12 months' time or in 24 months' time. So we are striving to achieve that level at 65% or even exceed it, but to good quality names so that we do not have an asset quality or a capital issue on the back of that. So we are pushing that button. There are two key areas we are looking to grow in, which we've been doing already. One is to investment grade names, which are the names you can count on in times of stresses, just as we've seen with respect to the macro. So our investment grade names, we have grown to those names over the past 6 to 9 months already. The other area that we're pushing, as several have stressed, is retail. So again, we see some good significant lending that we picked up with respect to digital lending and other aspects of retail lending. So these are two areas that we're pushing, and we should see the numbers picking up with respect to meeting the LDR and other interesting opportunities that come. We will take them safely, like I've said already. Thank you.
Let me just add a little bit to what Greg said. As an institution, we took a position to try and de-risk our balance sheet right from when we did our combination with Diamond. And so some of the currency exposure that existed at that particular point in time, we've made rapid efforts, obviously, to de-risk and to do those conversions. And the simple reason was the fact that we believe that, quite frankly, this situation may not always remain the same, over time. However, we know that our regulators are obviously focused on price stability. We'll do what is necessary together with ensuring that whatever we need to do to basically boost our reserves, we'll ensure that price is managed, if you like. But what we've done as an institution is to make sure that we try to insulate ourselves reasonably as much as is possible from the problems that we see. We note the recent excitement coming up in the market that is taking a lot of foreign portfolio investors to take their monies out, but we're also seeing monies coming into the system. And as a result of all of that, what we've done is to basically revisit our portfolios and look at them, very, very carefully with a view to stress testing them for currency risk, stress testing the whole thing for liquidity risk, and basically ensuring that we migrate very quickly, even though we've done that for a long time, towards the better quality names if you were to give any type of foreign currency exposure. So those are the things which we've done to basically try to insulate ourselves given the lower oil prices which we're beginning to see at this point in time. However, like Greg said, it's not possible for there to be a complete meltdown and any sector will be protected. But as much as possible, the idea is for it to be a local currency where you know that the natural charge will be to end it and you'll be in a position to be able to manage it. Thank you very much. Next question.
Thank you, sir. The next question we have is from Simi Ojumu from APSA. Please go ahead, sir.
Hi, this is actually Timothy Wambu. I just want to ask a few questions. The first one is, how much scope do you see for lowering the cost of funds? As you mentioned, it's at 5%. You will say that's quite high, compared to the next bank. The other question is about your treasury yields, which, again, when I compare to the next bank, were quite high. Does that imply that you were probably invested in longer dated papers? I just want to get the sense as to why your treasury yield was much higher compared to the next bank. Yeah. And then just lastly, what's your strategy in Kenya, given that you've gotten your license? Transnational Bank being a fairly small bank, what strategy do you have in mind? What do you intend to achieve? Thank you.
Rizal, do you want to speak to them? Yes,
yeah, sure.
Okay,
so on cost of funds, what you had looked at was historical average, which was about 5%. If we look at what it is we've done between December and today, we've shaved off about 200 basis points on that cost of funds that you have. So, and that's something we're tracking every day. The impact you will see on the Q1 numbers. Our cost of funds on the Naira side has dropped about 250 basis points. On the dollar balance sheet, about 150 all basis points. So we've tightened that delta that existed between ourselves and the next bank, as you referred to. And we expect that there'll be another significant drop in March. And then the next time we'll see a significant impact is sometime in September slash October. So we're confident that the delta will not be more than 100 basis points at the end of the year, given all the work that we're doing and the repricing of our balance sheet that has gone on for the last 3 months. On the treasury yields, you are not doing anything significantly different from the rest of the market. So I guess the question will be, what are the other banks doing that is not showing the real yield on their treasury portfolio? I mean, the numbers in themselves will show a yield that is well within market yields and return of those instruments that we're carrying. So nothing exciting that we're doing, and nothing different that we're doing. As you know, the treasury and fixed income portfolio just manages excess liquidity that any financial institution has at any point, and that's what we're doing with the significant liquidity we have. On Kenya, we're excited to be in the market. We recognize it's a different market from several African markets. Our idea with Kenya is that it's going to anchor a lot of the conversations we're going to have within the Eastern African market. We want to be dominant in Kenya. We don't want to remain a small bank. I think the platform of TNB just gives us an opportunity to get our foot into the market and begin to do interesting things as we see them. Trade finance is one aspect of the business in Kenya that we intend to focus on. But I think beyond trade finance, the retail banking opportunities that are there, recognizing that we have to do so with scale, means that we have to do things differently. I'm not going to give out too much of what we are planning to do with TNB at this point, because that will be sharing too much. But clearly, Kenya will be dominant for us for East Africa. We're going to acquire scale in Kenya. And TMB is just the beginning of the platforms that we're going to use towards achieving that. Thank you.
Let me just add a little bit of light to the issue around the cost of funds. Like I mentioned earlier, that was one of the points we have been criticized for. And today, if you look at our average cost of funds down to 3.5%, like Roosevelt said, compared to the next bank, if we were to split that cost of funds structure, if you take only the local currency part of it, we are probably at about very close to the same level. It's about 2.38. That is for the local currency portion. I'm not sure that you have any of them, any of our banks that is doing more than 20 or 30 basis points better than that. So what is happening is the long-term funding sources of our dollars needs to be repriced and the structured funding. Now, as they mature, we are repricing them. And so you're going to see the full impact as we move on through this year. Now, none of them can get the full benefits as we would, all right, because from the efficiencies that they have, it is impossible for them to generate any better. But in our own case, if we bring in and tighten that delta to what is a 50 basis points to 100 basis points against a balance sheet of our size, I think you will see the significant improvement in efficiencies of Access compared to the rest of the market as we move on. So thank you very much. Next question, please.
Thank you, sir. The next question we have is from Jerry from Cardinal Stone. Please go ahead.
Yeah, Harold, thank you for taking my question. I just want to know if we're to expect in 2020 more one-off costs, one-off integration costs? I mean, I know you said last year we did see some of this coming. Expect more one-off costs related to the integration take place in 2020. Secondly, so last year a lot of focus was on loan recoveries and restructuring and all that. I just want to have a sense of what your loan growth expectations would be in 2020. And you had mentioned that you're looking at investment grade names. So what kind of sectors are you looking at in that regard? So what sectors do you think will give you the kind of resilience that you want to see as you make your lending decisions? Yeah, those are my questions for now.
Okay. I think Shay,
you can speak to the issue. With respect to one of course, integration is done. We are now operating as one bank. Just like Heber said, one process, one people. So everything that you see will come in as a business as usual. You know, so there is no integration cost, you know, coming into for 2020.
Greg, you want to speak to the issue around loan recovery and loan growth?
Yes. Okay, so as we advised earlier on, I think we had in our previous calls, we had been asked about loan growth expectation for 2020. So that has not changed. We're still looking at 10 to 15% growth range. Of course, in the current environment, we have to keep watching that space. All sorts of variables are up in the air. But that growth, we are targeting investment grade names, like I said earlier on. There are a good number of sectors. So there are sectors that you might say, well, this sector is not a good sector right now. And the usual scapegoats are real estate, etc. So we'll not be looking to grow significantly there. But there are areas, even in oil and gas, with the right name, you will be able to do some lending. Prior to now, that would have held water, but of course, with the current coronavirus threat, everyone is going to watch that space for a few months. So your good, stable manufacturing, your good, stable, fast-moving consumer goods, retail, as I said earlier on, those will always be fertile harvest ground because they are reasonably diversified by definition, and conglomerates are also a good place to lend in times of uncertainty. So that is not going to be different. But investment-grade names are the primary goal, whichever of these sectors we do play in. And retail is of primary importance for us as well.
I'll just add a few more to what Greg said. There are some interesting opportunities that are beginning to rear their heads in terms of areas to lend to, one of which is infrastructure, done through a closed structure to ensure that you're not open to government risk and things like that. So that is coming up very strong. There are things in the telecom sector coming up very strong. Some reasonable, good, foreign, international oil and gas names, particularly the majors. Gas is looking a bit interesting. So across all of those sectors. But one of the things and areas we want to be known for is just that the growth will not measure up in terms of the overall size, will be with respect to retail. We are investing a lot of money in analytics, in artificial intelligence, to basically understand lifestyle products and to look at how to integrate the entire retail lending loop. If you asked us 3 years ago or 4 years ago, would we be lending to SMEs, we would have said no. How much what would be the portfolio to individuals would have said very, very significant. But what we're beginning to see, and because of our share size, the portfolio based on payday loans is very significant. There are some months now, some days when we give about 40,000 individual loans to people who are basically taking short-term loans to run their supermarkets, to pay salaries, to pay people, etc., etc., etc. The yields there are significant, and if you have the right algorithm, the cost of risk is not that much. Okay, so we are beginning to develop aspects of our lending to begin to make sure that it starts to grow. When you meet other international banks, whether it is Barclays or it is HSBC or JP Morgan, etc., those skills have been formed over time, all right, and they're able to lend to people in a manner that they can collect their money. Working together with the central bank and what we just referred to as the GSI, All right, we believe that we can strengthen that whole portfolio, all right, and make it profitable and all of that. Those were one of the significant reasons why we did the combination with Diamond. And it would be wrong for us not to also look at the lending side of the book while growing cheap retail deposits to make sure that the overall yield is enhanced. We've done it so far, and I think we're getting more successful at it. It's just that in proportion to the large names, you may not see that much, but in terms of where the portfolio is growing to, I think it's significant and it is diversified and basically supporting the overall value chain. So those are the areas you're likely to see us do a bit more.
Okay, next question. As a follow-up, Hello.
Go ahead.
Yeah, you have a follow-up. So as a follow-up, so since speaking to loan, and especially from an asset quality side of things, based on your experience last year dealing with some of the inherited or imported asset quality issues from Diamond Bank, can you speak to the kind of engagement that you had and what you expect in 2020? So of these loans, how much of them do you think will be written off, and how much of them do you think can be restructured based on the experience or from the engagement that you've had with some of these obligors? I just want to know what's going to be the key driver to bringing the NPLs down, if it's write-offs, or we're going to see some improvements in restructured loans from that side. Then secondly, if you can speak to the implications or the impacts of what we've been seeing on the CRR side of things, it appears that the central bank has been a bit arbitrary in debiting banks. How, in what ways have that constrained your liquidity? And you said you're not looking at going to the market to raise euro bonds. So would you be aggressive to get your funds domestically? Or I don't know. So just can you speak to that, really?
Okay, let's speak to the first one.
Okay, so with respect to the erstwhile Diamond Bank's loan book, of course, we've done a significant amount of work on this. We've been doing that for about a year now. Actually, it's exactly a year now. So the main things that we've done have been around restructuring, which we've also shared with you in the past. Restructuring means that in some cases, you'll find some names that are in business, they are running, except that the structure that was in place at the old Diamond Bank no longer suited their current realities. So those were straightforward. These were willing and able players, and all we had to do was to create the right structure. In some cases, it was migrating them from a plain vanilla term loan to a project finance facility. And that's made a lot of difference. Over this 1 year period, some of them have already made the first payment post restructuring, which gives us the confidence that, you know, we're on the right track. And if there's, if the impending headwinds from coronavirus do not subsist, we should see them pick up firmly and from then on migrate up the ladder, probably back up to even stage one at some point. So that's the first main thing. The engagements, like you alluded to, have been very, very robust from day one. At the highest levels of the bank, we've met all significant borrowers of the old Diamond Bank. And name by name, we were able to agree actions to take. In some cases, where there was a recalcitrance, it was a clear case of recovery. Take the full provision, write it off, pursue for recovery. And even on the recovery side, like Herbert said earlier on, we have achieved a measure of success, and there are a few more that were written off that were still chasing for recovery. With respect to the outlook for those names post-restructuring, now that they're running on the right structure, we do expect a good chunk of them to perform in line with that expectation, because the cash flows are fresh cash flows based on what they do today, based on site visits to see what exactly they're capable of, and we've verified those recent developments. For those that are not able to meet it, we'll do the normal prudent thing. So over a 12, 24-month period, depending on the structure, if there's one or two that are not stepping up, it will become BAU for the bank, just like we'll treat any other Access Bank borrower. So that is the state that we're at now. There's hardly any distinction at this point between the old Access and the old Diamond, just the cash flows that we have to see and performance, and when we see any deterioration, we'll take decisive action.
Thank you. With respect to CRR, I think that the central bank is determined to ensure that banks lend to the real sector. So I will not describe their actions as being arbitrary. And they will take the actions that are necessary to basically ensure that banks continue to support the real sector. Obviously, it puts everybody under pressure because rather than looking for the low-hanging fruits, we all have to concentrate on seeing how we can support retail, on seeing how we can support the real sector, and start to see the opportunities are that many. But I think we are known for our capacity to create good quality loans and create good, decent enough pipeline. So that's what we're working on. But are we coming back to the market to issue Eurobonds? I can tell you for now, that's not on the table. We are determined to bring down our overall cost of funds. And so even looking at the domestic market, it is something that is not of high priority to us. All right. What is more important to us is that cost of funds, which is down to about 2.38 on the local currency side. How do we basically push it to fall at least to the same level, which is not below, not more than 20 to 30 basis points in terms of our comparator banks? And how do we bring down the overall cost of foreign currency on our dollar balance sheet, so that on a composite basis, all right, we'll probably be at the same level. Given the size of our balance sheet, we think that once that is done, in terms of the overall returns, return on equity, return on assets, and things like that, we will be where we're supposed to be. There is always a lot of excitement each time there's a combination. We also know that, quite frankly, yes, we've got more combinations than other people or more than other banks in the industry, and therefore we're in a better position to generally tell stories with respect to what can happen. There is no rule or thing that says that you cannot have another thing blow up or raise of concern, if you like. But let me simply put it this way. The reasons behind the merger, the cost synergies and all of that will always, all right, be in fine excess of anything that comes out, because I think we've gone through this balance sheet and assets with a toothpick to identify whether they're falling to on a risk basis, whether it's 1, 2, or 3, whether the restructure is based on changes in the macro or the cash flow situation of the enterprise. So we have gone through all of that, and we know that sometimes, in some cases, we may see some vulnerability. But in the main, we think that the overall savings and synergies that come from the combination will be fine, excess of all of those things. Thank you very much. Next question, please.
Thank you, sir. The next question we have is from Wale Onkurumbuya from Sigma Pensions. Please go ahead.
All right. Hello. Good afternoon. Thank you for your presentation. I have two questions. One is on your, I don't know if it's been answered. They've been asked that because I just joined the call. One is on your disclosure with regards to insider trade, insider-related trading. Early in January this year, we saw, you had a closed period at the end of last year, and then it was suspended. I'd like to get a clear explanation of why the suspension took place. What is the internal policy with regards to trading during closed periods, or what's the policy around closed periods, and also around also suspending closed periods? What informed most of those decisions? And secondly, the CEO has been selling down his shares for the last 2 years. What's driving that? Is he no longer convinced about the case, or what exactly is it? Because he's sort of sending a different message to those of us in the market. And then thirdly, on the FX losses, can you maybe provide an explanation on that? What do I suspect you must have answered it earlier on the call, maybe. Yeah, but just a bit of color on that. That'll be all.
All right.
Thank you very much, Wally. My name is Herbert. Let me speak to the one that deals with me specifically, then I'll let my colleagues speak to the broad policy issues. In fact, let Russell speak to it, and then we'll
all
take
right.
it from there.
So, on Wally, thank you for your questions. I think it's wise to state that with respect to insider trading and the issues that you alluded to, the bank has continued to lead governance within our market, and in respect to trading of key stakeholders in the institution, that is no different. So I know there's a lot of excitement in social media. We all get excited reading bad news or what we think is bad news. Unfortunately, in this instance, that's not what it is. So all the rules that apply to any listed institution was followed through. And I'm sure you would have seen that both SEC or NSC had nothing to say with respect to this. I don't think we should give it too much air, because if we do, we're only supporting and encouraging sensational reporting to continue. So that's one. Secondly, with respect to Herbert's holding in the institution, I'm not sure where you get this information from about him selling. So you can look at the bank's financial statements for the last 18 years and look at chronicle if his holding has been increasing or reducing. I think let's not give rise to excitement. Let the facts speak for themselves. The financial statements are there. You can review from 2002 when we joined the bank to 2019, the last report that you have, and then you can make a call yourself. So I'm not sure we should give it too much air. Thank you.
Shay, you want to speak to FX losses?
Yeah, I think I would just repeat what I said before. I don't know whether you were at the March investor call where we stated that we will see some winding, I think about 15 billion a quarter. And I think what we've seen is not inconsistent with what our expectations are. What is happening is that this issue, a timing issue of recognition of the income, and as you see the instruments, when they get to maturity, some of these things tend to unwind. So this is, we thought this was, we knew this was going to happen, we planned for it, and if you look at our financial model that we have, this is already built in, and therefore, so for us it's something that we know what's going to happen and we planned for it.
Let me just, I'll just make a few comments with respect to some of the things Wale said, and perhaps, you know, we can close that and move to another question. We've run this bank for 18 years and a bit, and right from the very beginning, we were determined to create an institution global in scale, global in scope, following best practice, showing that coming out of Nigeria, coming out of Africa, we can truly create a global enterprise. We're also aware that this can never be an easy task, and that as you move on through life, you will come across several hurdles. Some you have nothing to do with, some you may have something to do with, some may just be communication issues, etc. But it's interesting that in this part of the world, what tends to happen more often than not is that as you grow, particularly when you grow inorganically, you would see a lot of these hygiene issues come at you more than you would ever expect. We will not run away from these challenges. We will continue to adopt best practice and confront them as they come. Suffice it to say, Wale, the fact that we were not on the call at the time we shared our strategy, local, I'm talking about within the context of Africa and internationalization, that we are determined more than ever to create a global enterprise. And for me, that's what is most important. On a net basis, we continue to have greater shareholding than we've done before. We will not allow social media or wrong news or fake news to basically becloud our decision-making context or our determination to create a global enterprise. I hope that suffices for you. And if you have any other questions which you may wish to take offline, please feel free to call me or call my colleagues or call my company secretary, and we will answer those questions to the letter. Thank you very much. Next question.
Thank you, sir. Ladies and gentlemen, just a final reminder, if you would like to ask a question, please press star and then one. I'll pause a moment to see if we have any further questions, sir.
Thank you. In the absence of any more questions, I just want to thank you all for hooking up to this call. I will look forward to seeing you in a few weeks when we'll be taking our first quarter 2020 presentation. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Ladies and gentlemen, that then concludes today's conference. Thank you for joining us. You may now disconnect your lines.